good evening. Many things to show you tonight, but first we should do introductions around.
Karin.
Mimi.
Eric.
Yeah.
Ross.
Marie.
Leslie.
Ron.
Judy.
Wendy.
Violet.
Nice to see you all. You lost your hair. We're studying the Four Noble Truths with the Dalai Lama's words. And we've come to the place, we're at the very beginning of it. So he begins the basic principles of Buddhism, which we talked about last week. And this week it's about the most important aspect or teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha. Sitting under the tree, he began to really, really look at how things were working in the world, in his world, in his body, in the tree that he was leaning against when he got tired, in the earth and the things that were growing out of it, and seeing more and more clearly how it was put together and coming apart. Coming together and falling apart. That everything seemed to be doing that. And so he began to really analyze and began to see how interconnected everything was, so that when one thing happened, it created the situation for the next thing to happen. And that created the situation, and that did too. And he began to see that everything was connected to everything in that way, that everything was moving and changing and being changed by everything. So nothing was still. Nothing stayed put. Even including his own mind and body. It's a very unnerving view, actually, if you really go there. It can be an intellectual insight. You can really think about it and figure it out, but if you take it really seriously and just be with it, you can begin to feel how it is. Dalai Lama says that, quotes the Buddha, actually the most important thing Buddha said was about this. This is called, the whole view is called Pratichasamutpada, which Thich Nhat Hanh translates as interbeing. Everything connected, everything moving with everything else, and affected by everything else. So it's a great dynamic. It's very so complex that we cannot possibly understand all of it. What Buddha said was, whoever sees whoever sees this interdependency sees the Dharma, and whoever sees the Dharma sees the Buddha. And whoever sees the Buddha sees the Dharma, sees the truth of things. He said, first the understanding is that interbeing, or interdependent origination, is common to all the Buddhist schools, whether it's the Tibetan Vajrayana or the Theravadin or us, or any flavor. This teaching is the essence of Buddhism. It means that all things and events in the universe come into being only as a result of the interaction of various causes and conditions. So nothing comes from nowhere. Nothing just appears like that. It's always coming from somewhere. And it's not coming from up there either. In Buddhism, you don't have a notion that there's some other being who is creating this situation. The situation is right here as it is. The second is that we can understand the principle in terms of parts and wholes. So we've talked about this before, that parts are the whole, and the whole depends on the existence of the parts. So if you have an ear, you need to have a head to have it on, and you have to have a head to put on the body, and everything is connected, as we know in the old thing, the head bone is connected to the, etc. This is true of everything. Every single thing is made up of little bits and pieces. And he said, we understand the entire phenomenal world arises according to this principle of dependent origination. Everything in the universe, as far as we know, that's how it works. So there's one more dimension to the meaning of it, and that is that all things and events, everything, arises as a result merely of coming together of many things, many factors that make them up. So if we look at us tonight, many, many factors brought us all together like this. If we started to really study it, it would be quite remarkable. All the causes and conditions for each one of us are myriad. And all of those somehow brought us into this place at this time, which is a very nice feeling just to think about. So things exist. Don't start thinking that there aren't things, because there are. This is a book, and this is paper, and this is you and me. But it's all tenuous, and it is temporary. Whatever we see is a temporary condition and is changing all the time. And that's why we keep hitting our disappointments, because we tend to think that the things we like are going to stick around and be like that, because it makes us happy. And then, boom, it changes, because everything does that. And then we're deeply disappointed sometimes because we feel we've lost something, even though it's just that our world is doing its thing. It's doing what it always does. So he then relates this to karma. I often say that when I was young in the 60s and everybody was talking about my karma and your karma and attesting to every situation as somebody's karma. Oh, you got cancer. Oh, it must be your karma to get cancer. But that really isn't karma. It's just that it's the arising of all these causes and conditions that we cannot even identify. There's no magic kind of force that's each one of us is related to is just how we live our life. And it is really up to all the situations that we can't control or identify that causes the broken leg or the happy marriage or the trip to Timbuktu. So he says, karmic laws are a particular instance of the overall general causal principle. So he says, what appears as some kind of autonomous objective reality out there does not really fit with the actual nature of reality. It's not what we think it is. Underlying the strong emotional responses we have to situations, we see that there is an assumption that some kind of independently existing reality exists out there somewhere, and develop an insight into the various functions of the mind and the different levels of consciousness as we begin to notice this. So our mental and emotional state seems so real. Our ideas seem so real. In reality, they're merely illusions. They're just a story. So reflecting on this, he says, and this kind of analysis will help us gain an insight into what is called the origin of suffering. Where did our suffering come from? It comes from our misapprehension, our misunderstanding of what life is. In other words, he says, those emotional experiences that lead to confusion and which afflict the mind, when this is combined with an understanding of the interdependent nature of reality at the subtlest level, then we also gain insight into what we call the empty nature of reality. Empty is such an unfortunate, helpless kind of word for us, because it doesn't mean empty in the way that we mean it in English. By which we mean, he says, the way each and every object and event arises only as a combination of many factors. That's what emptiness is. It just means everything is only tenuously connected. Nothing has any independent or autonomous existence. So this state of knowledge, he says, where such misapprehensions are eliminated completely, that's the state of cessation. You could say that's the state of enlightenment. And we stop imagining things that aren't so. Now, there is a whole operation, you could say, or a whole understanding that Buddha came up with, a kind of picture of this, which is called the links of causation. It's on this page, where, and Judy knows these. Could you say what they are, or am I putting on a spot? Okay, I'll say them. It's a circle, and it doesn't begin or end anywhere, But it, what Buddha saw first was his ignorance about all of this, his real not knowing, and saw that it was connected to its perceptions, and those were connected to his consciousness. And that brought him to stuff, mind and matter. And that brought him to his senses. How do I know these things? Through my eye, ear, nose. From the senses, contact. Oh, I touch it. From that I get feelings. Oh, I want it. I don't want it. From feelings comes craving. That's the I want it. From craving comes clinging. Not only want it and I get it, but I don't want to let it go. To becoming, to creating a whole world around this thought. And through this, the birth of a whole self. And from that, the whole descent into old age and death, which results in ignorance. You can see this as a psychological exposition about every moment of our life. You can see it as a kind of ancient trope, a story that they put together to try to explain how things work. The Tibetans put together a very beautiful picture of it. There are two versions of this. You can find a lot of versions online. I'll pass these around. But this is a big circle with all of those expressed as little pictures of people suffering and doing all the things that lead to the suffering because of these things that are enumerated. And then in the middle is the snake and the rooster and the pig for greed, hate, and delusion. And that's the hub that turns the whole wheel. It's a very cool idea. And the monster that's holding it is time. So time is eating the whole situation continually, gnawing on it. This one especially is very dramatic. And this one explains a little better what each piece is of it is. So the idea of these is that if you go around from ignorance around to old age and death, that's how suffering is created. That we end up grasping at things and clinging to things, and that inevitably leads to disappointment and suffering and old age and death, some kind of ending. And the other way, if you go around the other way from old age or death to becoming and birth and clinging, that helps you to see it more clearly, and it becomes a way to end suffering. That it's just these things. Oh, it's only these things. It isn't really the same thing as reality. It's just how we experience it, think it. So Buddha said the secret of the universe lies in causality. this is because that is. This is not because that is not. This ceases to be because that ceases to be. So I think that's enough. There's time for questions, discussion.
Presented before, and it's blown my mind before, and then I move on to something else, and then I present it. So I'm kind of asking for how a little more practical. How do I work with this? How do I work with this last secret about causality?
Well, one way of thinking about it is just not to take anything too seriously. Of course, it's more complicated than that, but in a way, that's one of the most helpful things, is just not to imagine that every event, especially emotional ones, is what it is, what we think it is. That we don't have to fall into emotion as if it were true in the way that we think we see it, the way we think we see it. So if we're in a situation, it's very easy sometimes to be very moved by something and imagine that it's ours in some way, and that our relationship to it is our possession, and that what happens with it, if it's hurtful, is our hurt. So it's about how we get to know ourselves in relation to our experience in the world. That if we're always bowled over by the causes and conditions that keep changing our life all the time, and make up stories about ourselves as a kind of victim of that, that's a story that causes great suffering. The truth of it is, it's just all these things, all these many, many things from centuries before you were born that brought it all into this one place and time.
So, two different paths, but one thing that seems practical to me is by trying to think about the interdependencies, it just puts you in a state of wonder.
Yes.
It's just kind of an open, you know.
Yes, exactly. So if something happens, it just happens. But immediately we go through this little number with our ignorance and then our perception, and then we feel it and touch it and come to a conclusion about it. We have, you know, it goes very quickly until we have a decisive answer to what we think it is. But we don't have to do that. We can bow to it. Just say, oh, hello, and bow to it. And then study it. Not as a piece of oneself that is wounded, but as a piece of nature. Awesome nature. It's hard to do. We take everything so personally. We don't want to do that. No, we much rather, you know, possess ourself in some way. But as Buddha is pointing out, it's not necessary and it's not true to do that.
So my last question about the coming of the step before death, the coming.
Mm-hmm.
There's becoming and then death. That almost seems like a relief. You know, if you build something that's artificial and then there's death.
But
they don't mean it in a good way.
They don't mean death is over. It just means you're starting over. You can never die. We're stuck.
But it seems like a relief from like the buildup of this stuff, this manifestation.
Well, that's because you haven't gotten old yet. Just wait. I'm not sure I can remember now. I actually learned it in Sanskrit. And I've lost it now. It's about Pratityasamutpada. But I don't remember those words anymore. And we need it in English anyway, so yeah. Leslie?
So, this week I had some suffering and emotionally, and it was attached to family stuff. And it used to be that what I'm trying to get a little clarity on is the difference between the stories we tell and the build-up around, because that's what I experience it as, and the way you said it, you know, we start to tell a story and then it becomes more solid, as different from looking at or acknowledging the causes and conditions,
yes,
that feed into, in this case it was sadness.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of taking on sadness at someone else's loss or someone else's experience. So when I sat down tonight, I thought, what if I just sat with the emotion itself, just sadness, you know, without the story?
Yes.
But is it also because of the interdependence? And how things arise, is it ever useful to look at causes and conditions?
Well, in the case of connecting and relating with other people, it's very important. Exactly that way, that if you're willing to feel for other people, you can live a more authentic life. And if you're able, you can, if not help, at least join in some way and support. And it's also true of happiness. If someone's happy, sometimes people's tendency is to be very grumpy about that and feel jealous. But you can feel just totally happy in the same way if somebody is having good fortune in some way. It's delightful to live that way. Yeah. Sometimes we have to cry a lot with other people. It's just the way it is. Well, they're just a couple of minutes before 8, and I found this on, this was announced to the Americans and teachers online and shared with us. It comes from the Prairie Zen group. It's a piece of music on the Bodhisattva's vow. It's not the one that we say, it's a more elaborate version of it that I think is out of Dogen. And you can hear it online. But this is the music of it. And I wondered if any of you musician people would like to see this and play it or play around with it. So I'll just leave it here in case somebody would like that. And you can look it up and listen. They have an MP3 that you can just turn on. And it's beautifully done. There are three voices. And it's kind of medieval sounding. Very, very pretty. Are there announcements?
So our next Zazen is on the 11th of July. We're
going to
be here the 4th. Which was sent out in an announcement. And if you didn't get the announcement, you need to see me so we can add your name, contact info.
And just a couple of points about forms in the Zendo. As we're getting more people, I think we need to scooch in a little bit, so we have people following for latecomers. The walking meditation is one half step for every out breath, so we get the pacing correct. When we bow, we face the altar. When we chant, we face each other, because that is a more harmonious kind of blending of the voices. And then the bow that Angie does when she's inside the circle of the altar, she does a little half bow before she steps back. We don't bow for that.
Thank you. Very helpful, Marie. One minute sit.